I think the sickness in the whole situation is in the myth that government and even industry set about rationally to do the things that will most benefit society. That's just crazy. That's not the world in which we live. The power industry isn't there to make power, it's to make money. The arms industry isn't there to promote our national security, it's to make money. Every industry you turn to is engaged in just one dominant enterprise, and that is to make money. And not just to make that much money, it's to make as much as can possibly be made at any cost in human health, human life, security, whatever you like.
George Wald is a Nobel Prize winner who has been a peace activist for many years. We have a wonderful conversation with him tonight on Alternative Views. In November of 1979, we did an interview with George Wald, peace activist, scientist, and Nobel Prize winner. The information and insights he presented to us at that time are just as applicable today.
A very special program tonight on Alternative Views. A great, good man you'll be seeing shortly, George Wald, Nobel Prize winner, activist around the world for the causes of saving our environment, saving our species. He'll be with us after some news. Militant Magazine reports about Chrysler and indicates that Chrysler has been selling a lot of cars and making big profits all along, but these profits have been siphoned off, particularly by the big banks and the other investors. In 1978, when the company reported a bottom line loss of more than $200 million, the owners of capital took of the capital in Chrysler took out $1 billion in profits. This is according to Economic Notes published by Labor Research Association. The stock dividends totaled $65 million that year, and the interest payments to banks, insurance, and so on were $166 million. Miscellaneous payments, oh, there were another $69 million, et cetera, and $300 million there for some for other items, but this is when they were reporting a loss. So what it amounts to, Chrysler pays $125 in interest to banks for each car and truck it sells, compared to only $10 for General Motors. Now, who are the banks? Well, our old buddies, Manufacture Hanover Trust, Chase Manhattan, National Bank of Detroit, Royal Bank of Canada, and all of these people have members on the board of director of Chrysler. So they also get involved with the management and general overall direction of Chrysler. So it's very obvious that one of the reasons they are so happy to have Chrysler get bailed out by the U.S. government is so they'll continue to get their money paid back. And it's all a nice little happy circle, isn't it?
Right. This is from Mother Jones Magazine, which has a 40-page dossier on the corporate crime of the century. And this was quite a disturbing article, but very interesting in terms of the information. And that is, in the last 10 years in America, the government has banned a whole lot of products, certain pesticides, certain chemicals, certain projects like intrauterine devices and certain birth control pills, certain clothing that had cancer-causing ingredients, were shown by the federal government to be extremely dangerous, so they were banned in America. Well, you might wonder, what did the corporations do who had paid to develop all of these products and had them stockpiled? Well, according to Mother Jones magazine, they have dumped them on different foreign countries, and that this has created scandals in that countries like in Latin America, in Europe, in Africa, and other parts of the third world have had these pesticides, these chemicals, and a whole wealth of products that have caused misery and suffering to the people. For instance, all of the Dalcon Shield intrauterine devices that killed at least 17 women in America in 1 year have been widely distributed over seas. There's been quite a few other products like this, like a lot of pesticides and different chemicals that were used on agriculture that has caused poisoning. Up to 20,000 people have been poisoned in Iraq by certain pesticides that were found to be dangerous in America and were dumped on that market.
Well, you know, not only are the people overseas hurt, but when we import the products from these countries, in come all these banned chemicals and whatever back into the United States again with little or no control.
Right. This is called the boomerang crimes. 40% of the coffee that we consume in America has been sprayed by this pesticide that was so dangerous it was outlawed in the United States, and likewise bananas. This has had some very distressing effects also, because a lot of this is things like vaccinations and drugs that have been banned in America either because they were dangerous or ineffectual. For instance, 20,000 people died in Mexico last year because a drug that was supposed to provide inoculation against typhoid and was deemed ineffective in America was sold to Mexico. They had a typhoid epidemic, and 20,000 people died who were administered this drug that just simply wasn't affected, and therefore called mass deaths. Had they had proper inoculation against typhoid, they would have been spared this. So this is quite a scandal. Now, what's disturbing about it is the sort of collaboration between these multinational corporations that produce this stuff and dump it on the third world market and use middlemen who are often smugglers, who literally smuggle this stuff into the country. In other cases, they get government approval. They get export licenses from the government. So the State Department has completely turned its back on this. They're aware that the problem has is in effect, but they just simply haven't done anything about it. Mother Jones has called for legislation that would make certain products illegal for export. In fact, it's interesting that some of the products that are legally exported that have been banned in America are stamped banned in the USA on the container, so that Mother Jones wants laws to be passed that would make these things illegal for export and would make dumping a criminal offense and would make the American Customs and the State Department control some of this activity, because again, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of deaths in foreign countries from products that are manufactured in the United States, deemed dangerous and therefore made illegal, and then sold in the third world. So this is the corporate crime of the century, according to Mother Jones.
We go now from 1979 to 1986 and report about an incredible crime carried out by the American power structure during World War II.
For some 15 years, according to an article in Covert Action Information Bulletin written by William Preston, Jr., a secret conspiratorial alliance between various American corporations and their Nazi collaborators betrayed and subverted U.S. national interests in the U.S. efforts to try to win World War II. This, of course, is not, those who study international capitalism, it's not surprising, because it was not without the big capitalist help in Germany, Hitler never could have come to power or sustained it. Well, you might have remembered just passing mention back in, there was a book was published back in 1983 by Charles Higham called Trading with the Enemy. It's subtitled An Exposure of the Nazi American Money Plot from 1933 to 1949. Now, we've seen articles, we've reported them on alternative views here and there about certain things, for instance, like Exxon, then known as Standard Oil, selling gasoline and fuel cheaper to Japan and Vichy France than it did the United States Navy during World War II. And other things like subsidiaries of General Motors continuing to sell trucks to Nazi Germany up until as late as 1943 from their foreign subsidiaries. And an amazing statistic, I saw it in another article, saying that every bomb that was dropped on England during World War II was released by a bomber, by a plane which is made in an American plant in Germany. But anyway, of course, this type of book will not get too much publicity, and it's been dropped pretty much, and the type of disinformation that we see from right-wing ideologues is constantly popping up. Well, you wonder, why did these people collaborate with Germany? Well, if you read the press back in those days, you find that there was a lot of sympathy, an awful lot of sympathy for Nazi Germany and fascist Italy on the part of the American business elite. Plus the fact that they agreed with a lot of the of Hitler's racial ideas, particularly concerning anti-Semitism. Well, so what are some of these things they did, the American companies did with the Germans? Well, they shared patents with them. They included the secret shipment of oil and aircraft production data, photographs, blueprints of military and naval bases, enough material on weapons to give Germans a clear picture of American armaments, as well as Alaskan and Northwest defense systems that we had. They sent oil to Spain and Vichy France, which was reshipped to the Nazis. They even refueled German tankers and U-boats, supplying tetraethyl lead, which was necessary for aviation gasoline, to Germany and Japan. This is during while the war was going on. We were fighting these guys. They manufactured in subsidiary companies abroad an array of communication and electronic equipment that helped the German develop artillery fuses, rocket bombs, and radio technology. They maintained crucial radio links to enemy nations in Latin America for intelligence transmissions. They supplied funds to the Axis via Southern Hemisphere sales, proclaimed that they were, you know, banned firms. They also made and repaired trucks for German occupation army in France, supplied ball bearings, et cetera, et cetera. And this is an interesting kicker here. They cooperated closely in financial matters through Chase Bank in Paris. And that's David Rockefeller's. It's the Rockefeller Bank, of course, Chase Bank, now known as Chase Manhattan Bank, and also with the Bank for International Settlements. So, some of these companies, well, Chase, of course, as we mentioned, Ford, Texaco, Standard Oil, New Jersey, now known as Exxon, International Telephone and Telegraph, General Motors, and some others. And to tie it all up, at the end of the war, people who'd collaborated with the enemy, the American, powerful Americans, they went into Germany, and they were appointed as the top occupation advisor. John J. McCloy, who was a top man at Chase Manhattan Bank, as well as the Ford Foundation, was named the administrator of Germany at that time. He was considered at that time to be the number one man in the American power structure, and later this was changed, and David Rockefeller took over. But this is the type of material you certainly don't get on the regular media. Here's another crime of, well, the whole system, and it's our quote for the day from Patricia Harris, the Health, Education, Welfare Secretary, when she was back in October 17th. She said, if all this country's poor lived in one state, it would be the nation's largest. And if they were in a separate nation, their total population would exceed that of more than half of the nations of the world. Let's see what George Wald has to say about a lot of things, including people starving. George Wald is a member of a minority group. Now, you couldn't tell by looking. And it's not the fact that he's a Nobel Prize winner in medicine and physiology. No, it's George, unlike his fellow scientists, or most of his fellow scientists, who bury their erudite heads in the sands of academia or cuddle closely and comfortably with their corporate controllers.
George actively is struggling against the problems which beset the world, these awesome problems which require immediate attention. He's associated with the Committee for Nuclear Responsibility for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He attends many of the anti-nuclear rallies around the country, around the world. And he's in Austin giving a speech for the Mobilization for Survival. George, the title of your speech is Survival in a Lethal Society. Is it really lethal? You know, today I came out here and the birds were singing and the bees were making love and the sun was nice. What's so lethal about it?
It's lethal on the grand scale, and in those nice words you just said about me, you introduced a problem, too. The problem, whether I'm talking outside my field, that seems to concern people very much, more than it does me. No, I'm talking in my field, because my field is life. I'm a biologist, and life is threatened as never before in the history of this planet. And some of the threats work slowly. And one threat could finish the job in half an hour. And that's half hour's interchange of the present nuclear stockpiles of the United States and the Soviet Union. That would be curtains for the human race and much of the rest of life on this planet. So that's what brings me out. It's a concern for life. And I think it's an uphill fight, but I am a happy person, happy doom talker. One of my friends called me a doom cup. Yes, and the only thing that keeps me happy is that I struggle. I'm angry. I'm as angry as can be, and that's what keeps me happy.
I've read some scientists or some people say that actually it's too late right now.
I think any sensible person would say that, would see and say and realize that the chances of survival are not all that great, and at the moment seem to be growing less rapidly. I feel as though I were moving through a fantasy world, as though you know, when we're on an express train to disaster with no engineer. It's absolutely mad. And right now, all you have to do is pick up any newspaper and you find that the great American indoor sport at the top, I don't know why I call it indoors, it's outdoors, at the very top of government is twisting the tail of the Russian bear. Bear doesn't have much of a tail, and I guess consequently it's mighty painful when it's twisted, but that's what's happening. Absolutely mad to provoke. You know, everything seems to be being done to provoke trouble.
George, you mentioned the recent flap between the United States and Russia. Certainly the media have given a lot of attention, been actually preoccupied with that issue. But there does manage to pierce that trivia nightly, stories about the contamination of our environment. Dioxin, ketone, vinyl chloride, asbesticide, asbestos ad nauseum. But I want to ask you, are the media asking the right questions about the lethal society and what should be done about it? Or are we documenting the symptoms rather than the causes?
Evidence of chemical pollution continues to spread across the land. A state official says it is so widespread and pervasive in Michigan that we can't afford to clean it up.
Smith lives in the area east of Los Angeles, where the smog is the worst. On clear days, he enjoys moderate exercise. But this week, he has not been able to even walk to the mailbox without his oxygen tank.
Some time ago, a substance that causes cancer in laboratory animals was identified in bacon. It is nitrosamine. Now comes a public interest science group that says beer drinkers are getting a lot more nitrosamines than bacon eaters.
Since DDT and similar compounds were banned because of their threat to the environment, they have been replaced by many more dangerous pesticides, more poisonous to humans. Some are known to cause cancer, genetic damage, and birth defects in animals. Because of that, some scientists say that the greatest danger might not show up at once.
Agriculture Department officials said today that PCB, a toxic chemical suspected of causing cancer, has turned up in food and animal feed in 17 states from Oregon to New Jersey. The department spokesman said people aren't in immediate danger, but there is a crash program to recall thousands of pounds of contaminated poultry, pork, and egg products. The contamination came from a single packing plant in Billings, Montana. And a Senate subcommittee revealed that highly radioactive water is still pouring from damaged areas of the stricken Three Mile Island atomic plant. The leak can't be stopped for more than a year, probably, and the plant's running out of places to put the contaminated water. The problem's an urgent one, and none of the suggested solutions has even been tried. Meanwhile, the committee members said there was a danger of seepage of the water to the outside environment. That plant is on the Susquehanna River, which feeds into Chesapeake Bay.
I think the sickness in the whole situation is in the myth that government and even industry set about rationally to do the things that will most benefit society. That's just crazy. That's not the world in which we live. The power industry isn't there to make power, it's to make money. The arms industry isn't there to promote our national security, it's to make money. Every industry you turn to is engaged in just one dominant enterprise, and that is to make money. And not just to make that much money, it's to make as much as can possibly be made at any cost in human health, human life, security, whatever you like.
George, publicity over the hazardous waste dumps such as the Love Canal in Niagara Falls has apparently led the chemical industry to launch a campaign to clean up its image. What do you think? What's your response to ads like the Monsanto ad that says, without chemicals, life itself would be impossible?
In your windshield is an invisible chemical called polyvinyl butyrol. This chemical, made by Monsanto, could save your life in an accident.
No chemical is totally safe all the time everywhere, but to make driving safer, we need chemicals like polyvinyl butyrol.
That's why every new car sold in America has a laminated safety glass windshield.
Without chemicals, life itself would be impossible.
That's about the most the most inane comment on a really serious situation that I can imagine. I don't know how foolish they think the American public is, at least that part of it that knows how to read. Yeah, molecules are all right. We're made of molecules, but we're not made of those molecules. Now, the chemical industry, which is willing to spend large sums of money in the conviction that the public is as dumb as can be, you know, and will take anything that's said to be expert and that has a little technical vocabulary in it. Dow Chemical Corporation, for example. You mentioned Love Canal. The problem in Love Canal is dioxin, which is one of the most toxic substances known. Well, Dow has been in a campaign to show that dioxin isn't an industrial waste necessarily or even regularly. It's just a product of combustion. People burning garbage anywhere, out comes dioxin, they say. I don't believe a word of it, but that's Dow at work. Now you have this inane story from Monsanto, so let me say a few words about Monsanto. Monsanto, my institution, Harvard University, Monsanto endowed Harvard Medical School, I think primarily the public health school at Harvard Medical School with $12 million. With some strings attached that are kind of interesting. But anyhow, $12 million. That made Harvard very happy. But you know, Monsanto varies its business. And Monsanto makes the detonators for hydrogen bombs. It does that at a place called the Mound Laboratories near Dayton, Ohio. And I enjoy that, you know. Public health and hydrogen bombs. That's Monsanto for you. So I think that the story is what I just said, and the rules that are emerging is beware of smokes and dusts. You shouldn't be inhaling any of that. That you can avoid, and that includes smoking. And the other rule that's emerging very strongly, another rule, is to avoid chlorinated hydrocarbons. PCBs are chlorinated hydrocarbons. Almost every chloroform, almost any chlorinated organic chemical. And let me just say, as a biochemist, chlorine does not appear. You know, they're talking the body has chemicals. Yes, indeed. Chlorine, to my knowledge, does not appear in any living organism on this planet. And yet it appears in innumerable organic chemicals used in, made by, sold by industry.
George, science was never a strong suit of mine, but maybe you can cut through some of the rhetoric here. They argue that some people think anything chemical is bad and anything natural is good, yet nature is chemical. But are they telling the full story? Isn't the petrochemical industry since the post-war, World War II era, producing chemicals that have never before been produced on the planet? And don't they pose a health hazard?
Yes, of course. And I would say that though petroleum is natural, I wouldn't be so foolish as to either drink, eat, or inhale petroleum or any fraction of petroleum. I mean, this is just utter nonsense. So, yes, indeed, there are both natural molecules that are things to keep away from, and there are a host, and a growing host, of synthetic products which don't appear in living organisms at all. In fact, you know, you want to kill a living organism, as people want to kill moths, as people want to kill insects, as people want to kill corn borers, as people want to kill bacteria of various kinds, you get yourself an organic molecule that those things can't live with. So this is just utterly inane, and any child knows better.
Only problem with cancer, though, in the kind of diseases we're talking about, it's not like an oncoming train. Its latency period is 25 or 30 years, and they can mask essentially the poisonous aspects.
Yeah, that's the dreadful thing. You can live a long time with that cancer getting ready. And yes, it can go up to 30 years, sometimes perhaps even longer. You see, we're in a desperate situation. Let me talk nuclear weapons for a moment. Nuclear weapons. You see, in fact, all the weapons. The arms procurement budget, the American arms procurement budget, all through the Vietnam War hovered around $24 billion. $24 billion. Now, the overt amount that we're told that the Defense Department is to use, $40 billion. And when a thing like SALT II comes up, the administration is actually, just in so many words, nakedly being held for ransom, being told by certain senators, either you increase that already swollen arms procurement budget by several billion dollars a year, or you don't get SALT II. And it looks as though we will have to purchase arms control by increasing our arms. But that's nothing new, actually. The present stockpiles in the United States and the Soviet Union of just the strategic nuclear weapons, that's the big stuff, those present stockpiles add up to 16 billion tons of TNT. The explosive equivalent of 16 billion tons of TNT. We're 4 billion people on the Earth, so that means 4 tons of TNT for every man, woman, and child on the Earth. That's just the strategic stuff. In addition, each side, U.S. and the Soviet Union, have tens of thousands of so-called tactical nuclear weapons. And incidentally, already stockpiled the material to make hundreds of thousands more, so I better tell you what a tactical nuclear weapon is. I was the American member of an international commission that in August 1977 sat down with all the available good data to decide what had happened as an aftermath, as a result of the atom bombs that we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The bomb that we dropped on Hiroshima and that just leveled that city, wiped it out in a moment, and by the end of that year, 1945, had killed 140,000 people. That was a miserably small, trivial 12.5 kiloton weapon, a tactical nuclear weapon, much too small to be counted in the SALT talks. So that's the situation. Now, facing that situation, you know, with all that overkill, with we able to wipe out with nuclear weapons every city in the Soviet Union of over 100,000, 40 times over, and they able to wipe out every city in the United States of over 100,000, 20 times over. With that, the present situation, we are making 3 hydrogen warheads per day and have been making them at that rate for at least the last 7 years. So, you know, is this insane? Yes, it's insane. Unless one holds an arms contract, and then it's business. And the bigger the better.
Well, George, even if we are able to avoid nuclear catastrophe, we're still liable to all be zapped by radiation,
yes,
by chemicals,
yes,
that we have unleashed,
yes,
upon ourselves. I say we have unleashed upon ourselves, but the corporate structure and the government
you
is,
see, I
has
think,
unleashed.
And I'll be talking about that tonight here. I think that the reality is that industrial revolution that just started 200 years ago, you know, 200 years is nothing in human history and still less in geological history. In 200 years, the Industrial Revolution has brought the human race to the brink of self-extinction. It turned lethal. That's the reason for the title of my talk. It turned lethal on the grand scale some years ago. And it doesn't just involve nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. Having said what I did about nuclear weapons, the business of making other so-called conventional weapons in this country is 3 times as big as the business of making the nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons business is worth about $10 billion a year, and the conventional weapons another $30 billion, and I have done the opposite of exaggerating. I have understated the costs and the situation. Killing and destruction is now the biggest business in the world. Worldwide, last year, we don't have a hard figure as yet, but well over $400 billion spent on military things worldwide in the past year. But it isn't just that. Industrial disease. 70 to 90%, so 80% is a fair figure of all the cancer in the United States is of environmental origin and hence preventable. We keep being told about crash programs to find cures for cancer. Much more than cures.
The war on cancer. Yeah.
Much more than cures. We just need to keep cancer from happening. The really big job would be to stop those environmental cancers. And of the 80% that is environmental, roughly 40%, so roughly one-third of all the cancers in the United States, happen in the workplaces. This is, of course, denied by industry. I've been watching this situation for many years, and I have yet to know an instance in which the industry fails to fight tooth and nail any attempt to clean up the shops, to establish standards, to get proper medical records. It just fights all along the way. When everything else fails, it goes into court just as a delaying procedure. The point is that any attempt to get at this situation increases production costs and increases liability costs, insurance costs, workmen's compensation costs. So the business of the physicians attached to all big industry is to save money for the industry. Their clients are not the workers, their clients are corporations.
Well, George, let me see if you can draw into sharp focus the basic choices which you think confront us here in trying to transform the lethal society into a healthy society. What are the impediments? You obviously are no friend of business. What are the impediments, business and otherwise, which stand in the way of attaining a healthy society?
Let me say something cheerful. You know, in my kind of circles, perhaps in yours, the cure for every problem is do research. You know, do research. Eventually get out a report. Well, research is fine. It's great. We never know enough about anything. But it must not be used, as it constantly is used now, as an excuse for forever deferring action. And I want to say something cheerful. We already know enough to begin to cope with all those multiple threats to life, human life, on our planet. But there isn't one of them that we can begin to cope with while maximizing profits. And I think that that's the bugbear.
So you would see the market system then as incompatible with a healthy society?
But I'm trying, I would want to emphasize that cheerful note. The answers to what are presented to us as insoluble problems are as plain and simple and easy for the most part as falling off a log. But for that very reason, they won't be taken.
What are they?
Well, name me a problem and I'll give you the answer as best I can. My God, can I really do that? Let's try it.
Cancer in the workplace.
Cancer in the workplace. Clean up the shops. There's no great problem there. The shops need to be cleaned up and properly monitored, and the permissible limits. We have them for radiation, radioactive. Those permissible limits are all purely arbitrary compromises between the demands of industry and their lobbies and the realities. On radiation, and I'm talking specifically high-energy radiation, so-called ionizing radiation. I like to say it this way. Every dose is an overdose. There is no permissible limit. A little does harm, more does more harm. And in most of these things that are killing workers and producing industrial disease in the workplaces, the limits need to be, the shops need to be cleaned up and the limits need to be brought down. And bringing those limits down under present circumstances is something that is fought by the industrial lobbies, by industry, by those sections of government that are dominated by industry, and if all else fails, brought into the courts just to delay.
But government would claim that they're in a crossfire between inflationary pressures, the kinds of changes that you advocate for the workplace would cause an unfair hardship, a burden on them that would put them at a competitive disadvantage with other industries.
You know, there's a knee-jerk reflex at work in this situation on the corporate side, and that is the immediate cry. Workers will lose their jobs. To hear industry, when it's asked to clean up a shop or to do anything else that will save health and life. You would think that the industry was in business only to provide jobs to workers. And sometimes the workers are so foolish as to actually resist the cleaning up at the shops for fear that they might lose their jobs. And you know a sad truth. You put any worker between his job and perhaps the threat of loss of his life, he'll take the job and let fate take care of his life. He'll take the job before any other consideration. So what we need is to clean up the shops and assure the workers that they will not lose their jobs. I think that coupled with many of the other things that I'm all for and go around talking for, we have to couple with those things the politics of full employment. That's very important.
George, we're talking about, and I agree with you when you say that a lot of these things are a result of the marketplace and of profit, and yet we find that the Soviet Union, the Cuba, and the socialist countries also are doing the same thing, not to the great extent, and not to the great abusive extent that they are in the United States and the Western capitalist world, but they're heavy pro-nukers. Is there something deeper? Is there some type of a preoccupation with technology itself as something automatically good, no matter what you come up with, and efficiency, regardless of profit?
I've thought about this a great deal, and I'll tell you where I come out. I think that any society that puts production, the maximization of production, as its dominant aim, ends up not very different from one that's pursuing the maximization of profit. I think there is, in reality, no nation that as closely resembles the United States as the Soviet Union. And yes, you are quite right. In that pursuit of maximizing production, they give the health of the workers and their welfare frequently short shrift. And I have encountered in... Just in Japan last August, I was in an international meeting that had a Soviet and a Cuban representation. And in fact, we had a meeting. In fact, I had more or less forced this issue on nuclear power. And everybody present was against nuclear power. The only ones who spoke for it at all were a Soviet Union representative and a Cuban representative. But to my surprise, and I was glad of that, both of them spoke very softly indeed, very circumspectly. And I just read in the New York Times the other day that a first criticism by an economist and a nuclear engineer had appeared in a top Soviet publication, criticism of the dangers in nuclear power. So I think the Soviet Union is being forced to realize this is dangerous business. I'm talking now nuclear power. And in fact, we have rather credible reports that the greatest nuclear catastrophe that has yet happened in the 50s in the Urals, and the Soviet Union devastated a large area.
George, there are some people who say, well, Homo sapien, mankind, is fatally flawed, and we won't be able to make it, that the life support system is too delicate to be able to handle this bludgeoning which we have given it. Do you think that we are sowing the seeds of destruction, and if so, are we capable of coming out of it?
Yes, we are sowing the seeds of destruction, but the world is full of... especially after you left this country, and I've been over most of the world during the last year. The world is full of decent, generous, hard-working people who are open, not aggressive, not very competitive, who want a chance to live decently, you know, and by decently I don't mean without working, and I don't mean a plush standard of living, I mean just have adequate clothing, be able to feed their kids, be able to find some sort of medical help when they need it, have shelter and education. There's a real hunger for education. I find wherever I go, and I've been pretty much all over the world, and I seek out the back country whenever I can. The world is full of decent people, and tell you some funny things, you know. You were asking, you know, solutions, simple solutions. Do you realize that we're growing now in the world much more than enough grain adequately to feed all the people in the world? And yet about two-thirds of the world's people regularly go hungry, and a lot of them starve. What's happening to that grain? Well, when you ask in certain circles, you're told there's a distribution problem. Yeah, there's a distribution problem. Food goes only where it can go at a profit, where you can sell it at a profit. No profit, no distribution. Second point, the world is now filled with people. My authority for this is that well-known radical Robert McNamara, ex-Ford Company executive, ex-Secretary of Defense, kicked upstairs by your fellow Texan LBJ to be the president of the World Bank, which is what he is now. He shouts about people in the world who are not just unemployed, but for whom there's no further use in a market economy. One wishes they weren't there. And because the world is increasingly filled with people who are not in any position to buy food at what will be a profit to the people who supply it, there is a new game afoot, and it's brand new, increasing at explosive speed. In fact, the whole thing has happened only in the last 10 to 15 years. And that is a fantastic, explosive increase in the demand for meat, particularly beef, in all the developed world and the more affluent portions of the underdeveloped world. Eating beef has become the symbol, the index of the standard of living now all over the world. And it takes 8 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of meat. And feeding meat to the affluent is a profitable business, and that's where the grain is going. The grain that could be feeding hungry peasants, workers, unemployed, is going instead to feed cattle and pigs and chickens to supply this explosively growing demand for meat. So I'm saying to you, the answers to these problems that are so life-threatening all over the world are very simple, but they don't go together either with a dominantly profit-maximizing or a dominantly production-maximizing situation.
George, it does seem to does come down to some basic questions of philosophy. Do you think that the demands for alternative technologies and alternative energies really constitute a demand for an alternative society, one that questions sure. the values of possessive individualism and profit and competition and instead has a vision of a cooperative, more communal way of living?
Oh, sure. That's right. I think what we need is not to maximize profit or to maximize production, but to maximize a decent life for people. And there, you know, people regularly, when they feel threatened or when they feel pressed, produce very mean feelings about grown-ups. But I think the essence of the whole situation is the children. You can't feel all that mean about kids. You can't feel threatened by kids. Kids are in our care. All kids. My kids, your kids, everybody's kids. And it's they who suffer first and most When there are shortages, it's the kids who are the first to suffer. And I think that that, you know, one of the crazy paradoxes of American life right now is the right to life movement, the right to embryonic life. I'll go right down the line with those people who want to take such good care of human fetuses. If they'll only join me in taking care of children already born, what we do to kids in this country and in this world just is utter disgrace. So let's try and save the kids who have been born, and then I'll go on and worry about the fetuses.
George, you're wonderful. I wish we could stay here and talk for hours, but we must share you with other people here in Austin. I know you have a very busy schedule, and good luck.
Glad to have been with you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, and George Wald, I hope that your next Nobel Prize will be the Nobel Peace Prize.
I'd love that.
Frank, do you have a bedtime story for us?
Oh, yes. We can't let people leave smiling or feeling good. In a 35-block area in Manhattan's Chinatown, some 5,000 men, women, and children work at turn-of-the-century sweatshop conditions. Adults and children as young as 10 years old struggle through 12-hour days, earning as little as $1.50 an hour, and they toil in very crowded, unhealthy, unsafe conditions. The U.S. Department of Labor said, well, conditions are not confined to Chinatown and the garment industry. It happens every day. Well, they're going to take these people to court, throw them in jail? No. If there are further violations, the owners may be held in contempt of court and fined a little bit, but nobody will go to jail. As a practical matter, even the workers will be unable to collect the back wages and overtime legally due them. So Congress did its usual job for a business when it failed to provide for standards of enforcement, but it really isn't anything new. Back in the 19th century England, Marx described what happened there. He said Parliament passed 5 labor laws, but was shrewd enough to refrain from voting a penny to provide means for carrying them out. I guess times haven't changed much, have they? Good night.
What I'm talking about is the black lung of the coal miners, the brown lung of the textile, cotton workers, the PCB poisoning in the electrical industry, the vinyl chloride. PCB and vinyl chloride are organic chemicals. They are molecules. Vinyl chloride poisoning in the plastics industry, asbestosis, silicosis, and a host of cancers and other diseases produced by a host of and constantly growing series of organic chemicals in use in industry. There are a few general rules that are emerging, I would say. One of them is not to inhale any particles, dusts, particles, smokes. The problem in Love Canal is dioxin, which is one of the most toxic substances known. Well, Dow has been in a campaign to show that dioxin isn't an industrial waste necessarily or even regularly. It's just a product of combustion. People burning garbage anywhere, out comes dioxin, they say. I don't believe a word of it, but that's Dow at work. And the only thing that keeps me happy is that I struggle. I'm angry. I'm as angry as can be. And that's what keeps me happy.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood and the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember. remember when you know that you've seen it before. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun, or a brick, or a stone, and there are lies in the balance. Enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die.